Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hubris and chutzpah, attributes never in short supply in American capitalism. Today, though, may take the cake. AIG and that bailout lawsuit coming up on the broadcast from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 8th of January. Good as always to have you with us. And we begin with what one can only call an amazing story. The board of directors at AIG, the insurance giant that 4 years ago was at the very heart of the financial crisis that got a government bailout saving it from all but certain bankruptcy. Well, the board of directors of that company will meet tomorrow to consider quite the unusual presentation. Former AIG CEO Maurice Greenberg is going to try to persuade the board to join his lawsuit against the U.S. government over that very same government bailout. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has the story from New York.
So let me get this straight. AIG, which almost went bust, betting on bad mortgages. That AIG, that got $182 billion taxpayer dollars, saving the company and the financial system, that same AIG is thinking of suing the U.S. government.
Let me just say, it is Kafkaesque.
That's Phil Angelides, who chaired the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Former AIG CEO Maurice Greenberg, who's also a big investor in the company, first sued the government in 2011 for $25 billion. He alleges shareholders were not paid enough for the stake the government took in the company. And that brings us to that surreal board meeting, where government officials will also be there, asking, "You sure you want to sue us?"
I'd pay for first-class seats in that room.
Henry Hugh is a law professor at the University of Texas and a former SEC regulator. He says AIG's board has an obligation to consider the lawsuit because of shareholder interests.
But they should also consider the costs of this in terms of their relationship with the regulators.
Don't forget, AIG is the company that just started running ads saying, "No joke.
Thank you, America."
A spokesman for the New York Fed said the allegations have no merit because bankruptcy was AIG's only alternative. That would have wiped out shareholders entirely. Angelides thinks the board shouldn't consider the lawsuit for more than a minute.
This is, you know, a real slap at the taxpayers of the country and a real slap at the government of the United States.
An AIG spokesman declined to comment, though in an email, he did say thank you. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
That AIG thank you ad that Dan played just to snip it up, well, it was nice and all, but it's also just too good not to make fun of right now.
AIG, we said we were going to turn it around, and we did.
We're helping Joplin, Missouri come back from a devastating tornado.
And now we're suing you because that bailout, it just wasn't right.
We're a leading global insurance company based right here in America.
We've repaid every dollar America lent us.
Everything.
That's how much we want back from
the American people.
Thank you, America.
No, really. Thank you.
Now, let's bring on tomorrow.
Corporate earnings season started today, about which two things before we move on. One, why do we call it a season anyway? And two, Wall Street really could not have cared less. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Almost as tantalizing as the idea of using a single trillion-dollar platinum coin to take care of our debt ceiling woes is the idea of what such a coin might look like. It is, after all, going to be a one-of-a-kind addition to the nation's currency supply. All right, so it's not really going to happen. But if it did, what would that coin look like? Garrett Burke was the concept designer for the California State Quarter back in 2005. Garrett, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So the Treasury Secretary decides to do the trillion-dollar coin. He comes to you and he says, "Garrett, I need you to design this thing for me." What do you do? How do you do this?
Well, first you have to take a step back and you have to realize this isn't a real coin in a sense. It's not circulating currency.
One hopes, right? I mean, he's not going to put it in his pocket and take it home. But
it's in a sense, reminiscent of the large stone coins that you would see on a South Pacific island.
That's right.
Like
yes.
The Yap. And so you have to take a step back and realize that, in a sense, this coin is a bit of a farce.
Well, all right. So let's go serious, right? Because it is were it to happen, it would be a serious enterprise. It would be a serious undertaking. So one imagines, as most United States coins have presidents or people of note on the front, you'd have to pick somebody to put on it, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, difficult because there's no one person of the American government that I could say would represent it. However, there is a person through history. You have to look at this as a history. A coin is a time capsule. And I think the appropriate person would be Charles Ponzi. That is the only person who I could
That was pretty good, man.
But done in a very representational way. Perhaps he's standing on a street corner and there's a portrait of him maybe speaking with some potential investors.
Yeah.
So Charles Ponzi would be one person that would make sense for me. I think probably the way to go with it is not to be too representational with it and to symbolize. So the idea that it is a perhaps a dollar sign that's twisted in on itself that forms an infinity loop, a loophole.
Well, then, like one of those Escher drawings, right?
The exactly, guy M.C. Escher. But then you actually just drill a hole in the coin, and that is the hole that all the money is falling into.
If it comes to pass, this is a coin that will be used once to backstop the debt till we get through this debt crisis, redeemed somehow, and then melted down probably and turned back into regular old platinum. So the question becomes, does the design even matter?
Always. The design always matters. And the design on this, if we look at it in a classical sense, who would it be? Because coins have their roots in Greek and Roman times. I was thinking perhaps it's an image of Icarus flying too close to the sun. And that could be a beautiful Art Deco type of representation, but also symbolizing the idea of the symbol of arrogance and the consequence of unbridled ambition.
You guys can go totally crazy with the symbolism, right?
Well, that's what coins is. If you look at a coin, right inside the word coin is icon, I-C-O-N. A coin is a symbol. So when you pick out any pocket change, you have some representation of our daily life as citizens of the United States. And that's why every coin has liberty, e pluribus unum, in God we trust stamped on it. So the design of the coin, what it says, the mottos, they really do matter.
And this one will say $1 trillion, too.
Well, I would not put $1 trillion on it. I would leave the option open that it could be a quadrillion coin at some point.
Yeah, because that's a debt crisis we don't even want to deal with.
Yes.
Garrett Burke, if you have seen the California State Quarter with John Muir in Yosemite, you know his work. Thanks very much for coming.
A pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
I direct your attention now to Section 306 of the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012, also known in the vernacular as the fiscal cliff fix that Congress just passed. Section 306 is an extension of a generous tax credit for repairing old train tracks, including something called short line railroads. What exactly are short line railroads? Well, I'm glad you asked, because Blake Farmer has the answer from WPLN in Nashville, Tennessee.
Think of short lines as the minor leagues of locomotion, or the on and off ramps to the rail system. The Tennessee Southern Railroad is pretty typical. It's about 100 miles long, picking up shipments of timber, chemicals, and aluminum in some pretty tucked away places, like the Etheridge community.
Being in Amish country, we have to be a little wary of horse and buggies, you know.
Engineer Craig Reisner slows down as he approaches a country road that has no crossing gates. There's really no need. On an average weekday, only 24 rail cars ride this line. The speed limit is just 20 miles an hour because the tracks are decades old and in disrepair. Most of the short lines were sold to mom-and-pop operators in the 1980s because the big rail companies weren't making money on them. In some instances, the tracks have been worth more dead than alive, just in the scrap metal value of the iron rails.
Their lines being abandoned, you know, more times than we care to say.
Matt Prince manages Tennessee Southern. He says his railway is beginning to bounce back from the recession, but he says competing with the nimble trucking industry has been tough.
It's definitely been a struggle.
Still, there are customers that depend on short lines. A giant Volvo front loader emerges from a gray cloud after dumping calcium silicate in a hopper car. The powdery byproduct is left over from an old phosphate plant in Murray County, Tennessee. Betty Runyon says it's being used as fertilizer for sugarcane.
we'll ship it down to Florida, and they, like the big stuff right yonder, and they pelletize that. Huh.
This company employs a dozen workers, including Runyon and several of her family members, in an area where jobs are in short supply. The short line is key to business.
Without it, I don't think we could do what we do here, and it really is our lifeline.
People in smaller rural counties that have been able to keep a job or a family member to keep a job is pretty darn important to them.
Ed Harlan does business development for the Tennessee Department of Agriculture. He says short lines connect rural areas to commerce, but they are underappreciated and underutilized. So he's out meeting with farmers, trying to drum up new customers.
The efforts to keep the short line rail are not nostalgic efforts. They are based on solid business and transportation issues.
Trains can be a more fuel-efficient way to move goods, though they do require more planning and often more time. Even as a mode of transportation associated with bygone days, 2006 was the industry's best year. That's according to the American Short Line and Regional Railroad Association. President Rich Simmons says there are pockets where railroad companies are again making money hand over fist near natural gas fields.
If you happen to be a short line that's in and around and operating near one of these shale formations, the money that you are making is unprecedented.
But most other short lines have been chugging along since the recession, trying to piecemeal enough work to keep moving down the tracks. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Coming up, Walmart and protest and pop culture.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming,
coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown. Ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
But first, a different kind of music. Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 55 points today, 0.4%. The closing number, 13,328. The Nasdaq sank 7 points, almost 0.25%, 3,091. The finish there. The S&P 500, why it dropped 4 points, 0.33%. That gauge stopped at 1,457. Problems plaguing Boeing's new 787 Dreamliner have now caused at least one Wall Street firm to downgrade the stock. Today, Boeing stock descended more than 2.5%. Cautious investors kept Alcoa shares flatter than a smashed aluminum can. Today, the stock finished precisely where it began the trading day. After the bell, Alcoa kicked off the New Year's earnings season with a word of a drop in sales. Still posted a fourth quarter profit, though, thanks to cost cutting. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Who is going to Cooperstown? We'll learn the names of the 2013 inductees to the National Baseball Hall of Fame. On January 9th, 1913, the 37th U.S. President Richard Nixon was born. And dining out, January is Be Kind to Food Servers Month, so if you've got to send your dinner back to the kitchen, be kind about it. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are, as I hope you know, a business program, and as such, we are occasionally required to be as cold-blooded as the businesses we cover. Occasions like right now. Flu season is upon us, and by all accounts, it's shaping up to be a doozy, which means all those people who've been waiting to roll up their sleeves and get a flu shot are probably going to get one now. And it also means the drugstore business, which is probably going to get the vaccine payoff that it has been waiting for. From the health desk at the WHYY in Philadelphia, Dan Gorenstein reports.
Today, one in five adults gets their flu shot from a pharmacy. That's why drugstore chains are trying to make it as easy as possible to get a vaccine.
We have about 1,700 24-hour stores.
Jim Cohn's a spokesman for Walgreens, the nation's largest pharmacy chain. He says just 3 years ago, half of all of the chain's pharmacists weren't even trained to administer the vaccines.
We're now at a point where virtually all of our 27,000 pharmacists can provide flu shots and a broad range of immunizations.
But Matthew Kofina, an analyst with Morningstar, says all those pharmacists giving all those shots doesn't boost the bottom line as much as you'd think.
even though it's administering over 5 million vaccines, it's probably a couple hundred million dollars versus total revenue for Walgreens of $74 billion or so.
Cofina says the real value for these retailers is that it's a foot in the door to becoming so much more than some sleepy pill counter.
You know, maybe somebody comes in for a flu shot initially, but then they also find out that their kid can get a sports physical, and perhaps down the road, Walgreens and CVS will use their clinics to become more involved in disease management.
Drexel Public Health Policy Professor Robert Field says he's been watching drugstores become a more significant player in healthcare, and he thinks it's going to help everyone keep costs down.
First, it's going to improve access to the system. Secondly, it's going to help because you're going to have lower cost providers offering basic services that you don't really need a physician for.
And if you need toothpaste, it's just an aisle away. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
In London, England today, the government of Prime Minister David Cameron administered yet another dose of austerity, a measure to hold down increases in welfare benefits in this case. More to the point, though, the Cameron government has just passed the halfway mark of its electoral mandate. And so from London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports on the effects of 2.5 years worth of austerity.
The war on the deficit has been waged by two parties in a coalition government. It's been at times a stormy union, but now, halfway through, Prime Minister David Cameron says the marriage is working.
We said we would come together, we said we'd tackle these big problems, we said we'd get on with it in a mature and sensible way, and that is exactly what we've done.
But they've fallen far short of their goals. They've cut the deficit by only a quarter, the country's lurched into two recessions, could soon slide back into a third, and lose its AAA credit rating. Oh, and analyst Bob McKee says the budget cuts haven't even begun to hurt.
The hit to people's living standards, at least from reductions in government services and reductions in welfare benefits, really only starts to bite this year.
So why the economic malaise? The government blames the Eurozone debt crisis, but economist Simon Tilford says the government's tough talk dented confidence.
The language that they have adopted, we must cut, we must rein in spending, we must accept lower living standards. This has unsettled both consumers and companies.
The ice to the right, 300.
Tonight, the government easily won a vote to cap welfare benefits. Cameron has much more control over Parliament than President Obama has over Congress, but Cameron is clearly struggling to administer even a moderate dose of austerity. The message to the US seems to be deficit cutting is not as easy as it seems. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Hollywood had a pretty good year last year, thanks to what you might call a new game plan from some of the big studios. Crank out fewer movies, embrace 3D technology, and bet on popular franchises like all those superhero flicks we've been getting. It has paid off, but in the process, part of the Hollywood infrastructure has been left behind. The thousands of businesses here in L.A. that service the film industry with everything from props to meals. So those businesses have had to do some adapting of their own, as Aaron Schrank reports.
Jackson Shrub Supply has been a Hollywood staple for 75 years. Plants from the nursery have played roles in everything from Gone with the Wind to Pirates of the Caribbean. But these days, fourth-generation manager Julie Jackson is renting out her plants for bit parts at weddings and private parties.
To light this 14-foot tree... Hey, Alan, how many lights are on a 14-foot Christmas tree?
On Jackson's 13-acre lot, men are up on ladders stringing lights on a couple of giant Christmas trees. About 2,500 lights on each. But these evergreens won't appear on screen. They'll be decorations at a charity debutante ball. It's the kind of gig that's become the norm for Jackson.
That's kind of the direction where we have to go just to make sure we can survive for Hollywood. If we relied only on Hollywood, we wouldn't be here anymore.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
The trees are trucked away to a ritzy hotel in Beverly Hills, and Gumercindo Reyes places them on the ballroom stage. He's worked for Jackson for 10 years and says business from parties and weddings has saved the company.
When everybody else was laying off people or cutting down hours, we were busy. And that's what we're at right now. It's probably half and half. Half of our work is deal with the party industry, and half it was the motion picture industry.
Most Pennywise producers are shooting outside of California, lured away by tax breaks in places like New York and Louisiana. With all of this runaway production, the once steady flow of local filming is now just a trickle. Adrian McDonald is a research analyst for Film LA, the agency that processes film permits for the city. He says there are a lot of businesses like Jackson's in California, now fighting for less work.
There are 6,600 film businesses that service the film and television industry in California. That's three times the number of Starbucks in the state.
Those suppliers are in a tight spot. Movie production in L.A. is down 60% from its peak 15 years ago. And last year, less than 10% of network one-hour dramas were filmed here. That's down from 80% in 2005. McDonald says some things are still shot here, like reality shows, commercials, and sitcoms.
The productions that remain, they employ the fewest people, they spend the least money, and they last the shortest period of time.
It's that uncertainty that's led some vendors to chase big-budget productions around the country. Lloyd Thomas runs a production catering company in L.A., but he's mostly feeding film crews in other states.
I have to leave my home, leave my kids, leave my wife, and go on the road.
Thomas and his fleet of mobile kitchens spent much of last year in Oklahoma. In 2010, it was New Orleans for the Green Lantern. He says local jobs are hard to find.
Almost every job now, especially in features, feature films, are out of town. There's a few here in Los Angeles, but most of them require us to go.
For suppliers who can't leave the original Hollywood for one of its rivals, reinvention is the name of the game, even if that means ditching the Hollywood dream for a steady job. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
A federal judge has ruled, at least tentatively, that Walmart can indeed be sued over accusations of labor violations made by workers who aren't Walmart's direct employees. In this case, they're temporary warehouse workers who were technically hired by local staffing agencies. Walmart is fighting back. A formal final ruling is pending. But as we have reported, these fights over Walmart's role as a global importer and a giant employer and a mega retailer do seem to be getting more and more contentious, and they are spilling over into popular culture as well. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been following the Walmart story for us.
Walmart's got 8,500 stores, 1.3 million workers in the U.S. alone, so it's not surprising the company's gotten into our heads and our headphones. We get it from both ends of the pop cultural divide, pro-Walmart boosters and anti-Walmart activists. I stumbled on this song covering a rowdy union rally last year outside a Walmart store in South L.A. It's a corrido by Latino warehouse workers. The lyrics talk of leaving one's homeland only to be abused working in the U.S. Here's something a bit hipper, L.A. hip-hop artist Philip Meza at the same rally. We need to raise up, we need to rise up. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. We need to wise up, devise up a way to get treated in the way that we all deserve when we are working in our pay. Sounds way better on the CDs he hands out to the crowd. Jump to Washington, on YouTube anyway, D.C. hip-hop artist Head Rock put out this video protesting Walmart expansion plans in the city's African-American neighborhoods. Have you heard the news? Walmart's coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something? Something more businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping. Okay, but the anti-Walmarters don't have a monopoly on YouTube. You've got your pick of jumpy, scratchy videos of the Walmart cheer, like these middle school cheerleaders welcoming a new Walmart to town.
Give me a W!
W!
Give me an A!
A!
Give me an L!
L!
Give me a squiggly!
Squiggly!
And yeah, the squiggly on the logo's part of the official cheer. Just surf the net and you find lots of tribute songs and DIY videos shot without permission in Walmart stores. In one of my favorites, these guys, Andrew and Caleb, walk into a Walmart in Sulphur, Oklahoma and do the Walmart song.
Old Sam had a vision, had a very simple plan.
Surfing, there are lip-sync dance videos to Justin Timberlake and One Direction, shot by friends sneaking around the store trying not to get kicked out. Not half bad, some of them. It's kind of a Walmart world out there. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We've talked some about the oil boom out in North Dakota and all the people who've moved out there looking for work. But not everybody who goes there finds what he's looking for. Independent radio producer Todd Melby is working on a year-long project. It's called Black Gold Boom out of Williston, North Dakota. And we've been airing some of the portraits of people and places he's run across. Today, a guy who hitchhiked from Florida to North Dakota with nothing but a backpack.
My name is Robbie Reed. I'm in Killdeer, North Dakota, and I'm from Florida. Came up here for the work. There's not much work in Florida at all. I found a job washing dishes 10 days ago at a truck stop, and I just got laid off because the boss said they had too many people on the payroll. But I'll be 49 soon. I don't know if I want to go into the actual oil industry. I came up here because of the higher wages. They start you out about 11 or 12, you know, just for a convenience store clerk, whereas in Florida, you know, you might make $8 or $9, you know, working at a 7-Eleven or something like that. So I'm confident about work, just a place to stay. That's kind of a different story. All the oil companies have bought up all the hotel space, and unless you know somebody in Williston to stay with, you're gonna end up sleeping in your car if you got a car. If you got a car or van or truck or something. I call it my mountain backpack, like the mountain climbers carry. I got my sleeping bag in there, and I sleep on the street, you know, not on the street, but I find me a patch of woods or something, or an abandoned building or something, and I just been winging it, you know, and I'm going to check on a job now.
Todd's series, Black Gold Boom, is an initiative of Local Ore and the Association of Independents in Radio.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, an item that does kind of make you shake your head just a little bit. Quentin Tarantino, as you might know, has a new movie out, Django Unchained, it's called. It's about slavery and rebellion and revenge as well. Themes that you would not think would easily lend themselves to gimmicky marketing tactics, or perhaps they would. You can now buy, courtesy of the distributors and some others, should you so choose, posable 8-inch action figures of the main characters. Slaves, masters, the whole smash. And with that, we are done. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Katie Long, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We do hope you can join us back here tomorrow. And this is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.